Welcome into the very first AWA Unleashed. We have finally gotten to the point where we are going to dive into one of the most historically important and maybe overlooked promotions in the American Wrestling Association. And I don't mean overlooked in terms of the importance of it, because we all know the names that, you know, went and came. But when I talk about the importance, I talk about the historical, the early days, and really the influence that the AWA had. And maybe for a moment, it might have been the go-to promotion in all of professional wrestling. And if we're going to do that, there are two guys that are along for the ride. These guys are the two most foremost experts on the American Wrestling Association. I'm going to bring in Mick Karch. He's the voice of Minnesota wrestling. And George Shire, he is a well-known and well-respected wrestling historian and author. And guys, I'm excited about this. I was before, but I don't know. What kind of feedback, when you guys put it out on your Facebook pages, and we're going to promote the hell out of those during the show, but when you guys, you know, kind of brought up the idea to the people that follow you for information, what was the response? Because the response that I got, and I don't get nearly as much as you guys do, very positive, like a lot of anticipation. But what kind of feedback have you guys gotten?
Incredible. The minute that I put it up on Facebook that we were going to be doing this, Chris, the response was great, totally positive. And what I heard more than anything was, it's about time. Nobody else was doing this about the AWA, and we missed this. Now we can talk about Crusher. We can talk about Kenny J. We can talk about George Gadaski and Vern and Nick. So just tremendous, tremendous response. Everybody's enthused about it, and we are ready to go.
Absolutely. The same for me. I just had a couple texts this morning, our private messages from people that say they're looking forward to it. I've put the word out there that we're dropping this thing and it's for real, and everybody's excited, and that's what we want. I don't think we're going to disappoint, because the AWA was the main event of wrestling promotions, and we are going to share that with folks, and we're going to have a lot of fun doing it. Mick and I have been together. We tease about it, but we've been together for 50 freaking years. And we've covered this business. We've been around this business, the AWA being our forte. And I agree with you. I don't think any two guys know it better right now than he and I do. Hey, there's an example right there. This goes back to 1972. And you
good
see, Karch, Karch was razzing me there already. Now, this is why I have no hair. You see what he's doing to me?
You know what? The only problem with that picture is that I should have started at the Adam's apple and worked my way up.
Me apple.
Look at that. I really am. I see over. Look at that little patch there. I'm actually yanking your hair out of your head.
Hey, man, this is where it started. This is from July of 1972 at the Minneapolis Auditorium.
Wow. 1972.
I feel like this is where I have to go. He's pulling the hair, right? I mean,
notice there's no my gig here. The ref is out buying popcorn as usual, so we get no.
So let's get into this. When we talk about the AWA, the first thing that everybody thinks about is Vern Gagne. And I want to ask you guys, when you think of the name Vern Gagne, let's play a little word association here. What is the first thing that pops into your mind?
Boss.
First thing that comes into my mind, first word is best.
Best and boss. It's great, because there are a lot of topics that we're going to get into throughout this this episode. And how this is going to go, guys, is I've got some bullet points and we've got some questions that we're going to answer a little bit later on. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to kind of ask you guys questions from a fan's perspective. And I'm going to let you guys run the show. You guys are going to tell us, you know, the ins and outs and everything that you guys experienced. So first of all, I know that, correct me if I'm wrong here, George, but wasn't the AWA, was it part of the NWA and then it kind of split off into its own thing?
No, never part of the NWA. In the 50s, Minneapolis was the Minneapolis territory was under the NWA umbrella. So we had Lou Thesz coming in during the 50s defending the NWA title. But in 1960, Vern Gagne and Wally Carbo started the AWA. They had purchased the Minneapolis territory in 1959 from the Dennis Stecker, who was the predecessor of his dad, Tony Stecker, who was the original promoter in Minneapolis. And Vern and Wally together made the AWA what it is. And there you see Vern and Wally, and this is vintage 1960. This, I think, is just a little bit before 1960, but this is where it started.
So I think when we're talking about the AWA, and we talk about Vern Gagne, and we talk about Wally Carbo, I guess I want to go ahead and kind of off-branch off of that then to start. We know about Vern, but, I mean, regarding Wally, how did the involvement of Wally Carbo come about? Because he's not a name that I hear nearly as much as the Gagne's.
Wally was involved with Tony Stecker way back in the early 50s. And he was the matchmaker. He worked as a referee. He was a behind-the-scenes guy. He co-promoted with Dennis Stecker when Dennis took over in 1954. And in 1959, in September, when Vern and Wally got together, it was kind of a natural marriage because Vern was from Minnesota. He was the hero in Minnesota. Minnesota Gopher, University of Minnesota, amateur background, Olympic wrestler from the 48 Olympics. He emphasized wrestling. He wanted his own company. So he bought out the Steckers with Tony or with Wally. Originally, they were 50-50 partners. And Wally was the background guy. And I'm going to let Mick tell some of those little things about Wally. But Wally was the background guy. And Vern did this primarily because he had gotten tired of not being able to be NWA champion. He felt that his credentials made him the obvious choice. So they come across with a fictitional, believe it or not, in pro wrestling, a fictitional story. But a fictitional story where the
I can't handle it. I can't. I'm sorry. We're done. If you're going to tell me this is fictitious, I can't handle
it. The fictitional story where Vern Gagne and Wally Carbo and other Midwest promoters were challenging the NWA and its champion at the time, Pat O'Connor, to defend to Vern Gagne, or they would no longer recognize the NWA or its champion O'Connor. 90 days. It goes by. No word. They play it up on TV in the programs. No word. And it comes across as that Pat is ignoring Vern. The NWA is ignoring Vern. And in August of 1960, it's announced that due to this, Vern Gagne has launched the American Wrestling Alliance. And he is the first recognized AWA world champion. I just tell folks, if you go to any websites and it says Pat O'Connor was AWA champion, eliminate that site from your favorites because it is wrong. Mick, Wally Carbo.
Wally Carbo has a legacy with wrestling fans as the scatterbrained, the totally off-the-wall fines and suspensions promoter who was never in control of his emotions and really was at a loss. But those who know Wally Carbo and how smart and how sly and how really with it he was as far as the wrestling business, Wally was dumb like a fox. And the persona that you saw on television had nothing to do with the real Wally Carbo. He was creative. He had an eye for talent. He was a smart businessman. He had the utmost respect from the wrestlers, from the roster. On top of all that, Wally was a real character. There are Wally Carbo stories that probably are triple X rated that sadly we really shouldn't get into on the program. But in terms of Wally's impact, George and I have talked about this. Wally was the buffer between the wrestlers and the money, Vern Gagne, whatever. When they had a beef, they went to Wally. Wally was kind of the father figure, the grandfather figure, whatever you want to say it. But they were more comfortable going to Wally than they were to Vern. Wally.
So Wally really had some legit pull. It wasn't just on air. I mean, this was, he had, he had legit influence within the promotion.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, like George said, you know, for a time they were 50-50 partners. And, you know, Wally was, you know, he's the front man. He went out on television. He was the face of the promotion, so to speak, the authority figure. In the background, of course, Vern was as powerful, if not more powerful than Wally. I think the only time that it was really let on a little bit that Vern was actually controlling things was in the 1970s when the AWA TV show would come on the air. It would say executive producer Vern Gagne, which in reality, you know, meant Vern was putting up the money for the TV show or what have you. But that, I think, was the first little look behind the curtain where they were actually acknowledging that Vern was in the power position that he was.
But I think you have to take into consideration when they did that, Mick, with that executive producer, I'm doubting that very few fans, serious wrestling fans, ever picked up on that.
Right.
They just, it was part of the credits. They turned the show off.
Who would be looking at it? And then at that point, it's like, do you really know? I mean, you wouldn't even know what an executive producer was. I mean, I don't even think today people know what an executive producer is.
Well, the thing is that with this situation too, you have to remember that in the 60s and into the 70s, kayfabe was so prevalent in wrestling that Wally being the front guy, Vern was never acknowledged as having any power whatsoever. I mean, Marty or Wally would come out and throw, threatening fines and suspensions to Vern, and Eddie Williams, the St. Paul promoter, he had issues with Vern Gagne regarding his sleeper hold, and they put him under the test that it was an illegal chokehold. I mean, there's a whole story on that from the early 60s, and that's a big time story because it hit the mainstream. Was it a legal hold? But Wally was the guy that was that buffer on the screen that I'm going to force the champion to defend his title, meaning Vern, or you have to wrestle this guy. And Vern was behind the scenes. He could never come out and say he was the boss. That's what made it good. And when Mick uses that buffer thing for the wrestlers, these guys, like within any company, you have a person you can go to that you realize it's the good cop, bad cop type situation. One of them is the tough guy. One of them is the one you go to. Just like kids work their parents. Maybe they go to mom instead of dad because they know they can work mom, but they can't work dad, or vice versa. And that's the way it was with Wally and Vern and the wrestlers that worked for them.
So why do, over the course of time, why do people forget about Wally Carbo? Why is it just we talk about Vern Gagne and not, you know, and maybe it's just the later stages that people forget about Wally Carbo? Why is he kind of overlooked by maybe just more of the casual fan?
I will tell you what my take is on that. The AWA, for all intents and purposes, shut its doors 30 years ago, 30 plus years ago. And the last couple of years, maybe 3-4 years, first of all, Wally wasn't around. Wally had actually started working behind the scenes for the WWE, WWF back at the time, back in the day. And because of that, you know, Wally's kind of removed from the screen. Plus, sadly, when people look back, and I'm talking about the experts online, when they go back and talk about the AWA, it's unfortunately, a lot of it has to do with the demise of the AWA and why isn't it still around? And, oh, if Vern Gagne, you only would have put the title on Hulk Hogan, if this and that. So the emphasis is on Vern. You know, why didn't Vern do this? Why didn't Vern do that? So you couple that with the fact that Wally had been gone for a few years. So the casual fan today kind of ties Vern in more so than Wally.
And, you know, the other thing tying into what Mick just said, by that time frame, the fans that were around, the older fans like Mick and I, we were of a different generation at that point. The fans that started coming to the wrestling cards in the early 80s, when the Hulk Hogan era started, and then you had today's modern wrestling evolving, they only remember Vern Gagne being in the limelight. And when Vern had his retirement match in 1981, that was a situation where Vern really became the focal point of the promotion. He was retiring, and he had come out on TV, and he said, I'm going to be able to concentrate more on the business side. And by that time, it was open. And then shortly after, like Mick said, Him and Wally had some differences. I have in my files the complete buyout that the Vern Gagne and the AWA did of Wally Carbo. All the figures, all the money, all the insurance issues, all the back and forth with it. I got all the attorney's letters that went back and forth. I mean, behind the scenes, there was a battle. And Wally, you wouldn't believe, he received a very, very lucrative lifetime salary after leaving the AWA. And like I say, I've got it in my files, all from the attorneys.
Well, I let's just go right there then, because there, you know, a few other questions I wanted to go, but let's skip ahead there. Why did Vernon and Wally split?
Wow. I think that's got so many layers to it, Chris. I know that from the 1970s on, after Vern produced the movie with William Frank, the original, the wrestler, Vern's attitude and his demeanor kind of changed. And I got it's hearsay, yes, but I talked to a lot of the wrestlers who were around back then. And because the film didn't do what Vern wanted it to do at the box office, his personality kind of changed. He got a little edge to him, and I kind of exacerbated over the years. Then, of course, you get the WWF invasion, you know, in the 1980s. And now tensions are really running high. So Vern and Wally are boom, but they are just like this. And Vern is getting more and more stressed out. Wally, in turn, is getting more and more stressed out. The WWF kind of lured Wally away in the late 1980s. Wally was doing some behind-the-scenes work for the WWF, of course, now the WWE. And sad to say, this partnership of however many years between Vern and Wally became so contentious. And George is talking about, you know, all the court information that he has and so on. I remember a couple of conversations I had with Wally where he would just say, I can't take it anymore. You know, I'm going out of my mind. I'm so sick over this and so on and so forth. So, again, a lot of it is hearsay. George and I weren't privy to what was going on behind closed doors. I just know that it was not a very cordial relationship towards the end, which is really, really such a sad thing.
Well, it's one of those things that's kind of like a long-term marriage. You know, everybody got along, things were fine, and then things changed and people grew apart and your lives changed. And, you know, they were getting divorced. I mean, that's what it all comes down to. And the one thing that I can tell you, though, is that if I were able to share, you know, so people here could see those documents, Wally was very well taken care of. Now, he didn't live a lot longer after all of this took place. I mean, Wally left us, you know, shortly after, but he was taken care of, and it was all drawn out exactly. He had a nice monthly or annual income coming in, the stock options that he had. Vern basically ended up agreeing to all of it, and they mutually parted at this point, and Wally wasn't talked about anymore. And, of course, that last 3, 4, maybe 5 years of the AWA, Wally was – actually, it was around probably 85, 86 when Wally was pretty much out of the picture. And Vern was now the promoter on record. So that's why I don't think that people forget Wally. I just think that it's the fan base. It was different. We don't forget Wally. Anybody that's age 50 and over, we don't forget Wally. But if you're 50 and younger, Wally Carbo is, you don't know who he is.
Yeah, because I'm 46 and I know about Wally, but I didn't know like the influence that he had in terms of just really the, you know, the interaction and how much he really was involved, because, you know, for me, I knew him as a figurehead, but again, he was only around for a little bit when, you know, I really, you know, was able to get into the AWA. I want to back up, cause I know you, George and Mick, I know you guys talk about the Hulk Hogan influence and whether or not putting the title on him would have made a difference. I want to get into Hogan down the road. But I want to ask you, because of all the guys that came and went and women as well, all the talent and whoever was involved, was there a particular selling point to Minnesota or were there reasons why people just didn't want to come up here? I mean, what do we know about the mindset of some of the individuals that were involved, you know, in and out talent or behind the scenes?
Georgie.
Everybody in the business who was anybody in the 60s, the 70s, and into the early 80s, they wanted to come to Minneapolis. Fans listening to us, when we say Minneapolis, we're talking AWA because Minneapolis was the headquarters. So the wrestlers themselves referred to it as always going to Minneapolis or working the Minneapolis territory. But they all wanted to come here. And in the 60s and the 70s, if you look down the roster that the AWA had, virtually, I mean, except with, you know, with the exception of Bruno Sammartino, with the roster that we had come through, literally reads like a who's who in the professional wrestling world. And Vern and Wally brought in every available talent. And it was always interesting because the fans would react to the wrestlers differently. Some wrestlers got over, some wrestlers didn't. But the AWA was a place they wanted to go. And two reasons, a lighter schedule, work schedule, and the money. There is not a single wrestler out there in the 60s and the 70s and the early 80s would tell you that they didn't do well financially and were paid well when they worked in the AWA. And most of them, and we can tell stories about this, most of them made more money coming to the AWA and working a lesser schedule than they could had they went to a Florida, Louisiana, California, New York, where they were working 7 nights a week. In the AWA, they could work 3 or 4 nights a week.
To George's point about that, Chris, Nick Bockwinkel.
Yep.
Arguably, Nick's best years were in the 70s and early 80s. Nick was actually offered a run with the NWA championship, and he declined it, which on paper, what the NWA, oh my gosh, the grandfather of them all, why would you? Because Nick could work probably half the dates, maybe even less than that, as opposed to the schedule that the NWA champion, Ric Flair or Harley Race or whoever had back in the day, and make as much, if not more, money. So not only did Nick opt to stay loyal to Vern because of that schedule, you know, Nick, who was originally from St. Louis, but then he lived out on the West Coast, lived in Hawaii for a while. Nick actually lived up in the Twin Cities area for many, many years. So he settled here. So at least for Nick, the lure of the money and the lesser dates was just too much. And a lot of the guys that didn't want to come up here had the same reasons that we don't like it. In the wintertime when it's 172 degrees below zero, you know, and you go outside and you don't know, you know, what town you're in because the brain freezes. That's why they didn't want to come up here. George has mentioned this before. Bob Roop, one of the greatest wrestlers in history. I mean, from a technical standpoint, Bob Roop was as good as anybody. And he would have been the ideal guy for Vern to promote because Vern was into the amateur wrestling background. Bob Roop was a Southern guy. He absolutely did not want to come up to the AWA for that wintertime schedule. So that's what kept a lot of them away from here.
And, you know, I'll add to it with Bob Roop. He came from Michigan. So Michigan, they have the same ridiculous weather we do all winter. And Bob told me, he said, Vern, talk to me. He wants me to come to Minnesota. And I said, I'm not going to go there. I left Michigan. I want to be down in Florida. I mean, the guy was smart. But going back to what Mick was talking about when Nick said about working that half schedule, Nick Bockwinkel sat on my very own deck in the backyard when I was interviewing him in 1996. And he said, when he got that offer to go and get the NWA title, Nick said, I sat down and I put it on, you know, pencil to paper. And I said, all right, here's what Harley is making. Harley Race was working. And this is true, guys. Harley Race would work about 370 days a year. Now you stop and you say, wait, there's only 365. He worked every day and some were double dates, double shots, you know, work an afternoon and an evening card. And there's some stories that go along with that. So Nick says, I put this to paper. Here's what Harley's making, and he's got to pay his expenses and that sort of thing. Now, here's what I'm making in the AWA and what I can make as champion. And I only work 3 days a week or 4 days a week. He says, basically, it ends up that I have half the year off and I'm making as much money. He said, that's a no-brainer. So I said, I'm sticking with Vern. And that's the way it worked out.
So what kind of a businessman was Vern then? Because you get to talk about the schedule and the money. I mean, in terms of just being able to run his business and, you know, maybe just, I don't know how the best way to describe it, but, you know, we kind of see where the business went with the, you know, the McMahons. Was there a lot of respect for Vern amongst the boys and the talent because of maybe the amount of work, the lesser dates and the more money? I mean, was he fair to the talent, I guess, is kind of what I'm trying to say.
I would say Vern was exceptionally fair to the talent, first of all. From a money standpoint, again, like George was alluding to, the AWA was a terrific paying territory in terms of dollars and cents. I mentioned a little bit earlier on that things started to unravel a little bit when Vince McMahon started steamrolling the country. The relationship that Vern had with the guys at that point, from a business standpoint, I remember Steve Regal, Mr. Electricity Steve Regal, not Lord Steven Regal. This is a couple of years after he had left the AWA territory. And he said to me that at one point, Vern said, if you want to leave, go ahead, because you need me a lot more than I need you. Sadly, that was kind of the approach that Vern allegedly took back then. The money was good. The guys would have stayed. But Regal said, I just wanted to be treated with respect. And because Vern was so tense and flying off the handle over all this stuff with Vince and having to defend his home turf, personality got in the way. And because of that, you know, the grass became very, very much greener on the other side, you know, in the mid-1980s for the guys. And they it was exodus time.
You know, I'd like to point out, too, that we're getting way ahead of ourselves when we're talking towards the end here of the AWA and like the Steve Regal situation and Vern being so intense. But here's the thing. That was not the Vern Gagne that would have been 10 years earlier or 20 years earlier, because the business was changing so fast, right, with no rules. When you had a guy like Steve Regal, again, Mr. Electricity, he was a hell of a talent. He wasn't a big guy, though. And in most promotions, even in the 70s, he probably would not have been a solid, continuous main event guy, but he'd have been a solid guy on that card and an asset to it. But when you get to the mid-80s, there is no promotion in wrestling, and there were 25 territories at one point, give or take. There was no territory that was more targeted than Vern Gagne's AWA. Vern was fighting for his life, and all the rules had changed in the business. Vern would tell you personally, if he were still here, that he operated under a handshake. They made deals. They negotiated. Their word was their bond. That changed in 1984 going forward. From there on, it was big contracts. It was, I'll be there for the show, and then they don't show up. Vince McMahon, God bless him, he's a billionaire. He's done something right. I don't fault him for that. But he would tell wrestlers, don't go to the card. Don't appear for Vern. I'll pay you to stay home. And he'd pay him more than Vern was going to pay him. Literally, he would do this. And Vern has got a card that night, and so-and-so, his main event, isn't appearing. How do you run a show? How do you stay calm and collected when it's falling apart like that? When you never had to, with but the rarest exception, had to worry about that in the 70s or the 60s. And that also goes to Vern. He was under attack.
I want to say, too, you know, if you look back at the AWA early 1980s, so we're beyond the 70s now. Mm-hmm. The AWA was so incredibly successful, especially during the whole Hogan era. I remember we'd be watching the AWA TV show on a Sunday morning, and there was going to be a card that night at the St. Paul Civic Center, and already they've got the crawl at the bottom of the screen saying tonight's card has been sold out. There'll be 500 standing room only tickets available at noon at the box office or whatever. First of all, until probably the 1980 era, that was unheard of to have a crowd of that magnitude. And I'm talking 17, 18, 19, 20,000 every single damn month at the St. Paul Civic Center. So the AWA, until, like George said, 1984, the WWF expansion, they were a big-time player, and it continued. A lot of people don't realize this. It continued past, you know, Vince's initial excursion or invasion into the territories. The AWA was still drawing tremendous crowds. They had the Road Warriors. They had Jerry Blackwell and Bruiser Brody and the High Flyers and Ventura and Adonis and everybody else on top. So the AWA, it was a power player. I mean, this was the place to be.
You know, and I'd also point out that there are people, some of the newer fans, younger fans, they will say, well, Vern was only doing good because of Hulk Hogan. Ugh. Well, I'm here to tell you that in 1981, 82, and by the way, for the record, 1982 was the most successful financial year the AWA ever had. But Hulk Hogan was part of this. But you also have to look at the roster that was around Hulk Hogan. You know, people talk about Nick Bockwinkel. Why didn't he drop the title to Hulk Hogan? I got news for you. Hulk Hogan would not have been as successful had he not been against Nick Bockwinkel, that heel champion with Bobby the Brain in his corner. And people don't realize that. And we had Jerry Blackwell. I mean, you talk about a guy who's out of shape. You talk about a guy who probably shouldn't eat a few meals by looking at him. But this guy was an athlete. He could do things for a guy his size that nobody could. And he was so hated. He was drawing heat with the Sheik. Don't ever take anything away from Adnan Casey. He was phenomenal as a heel, always threatening to take the title back to Iraq. And other stars, Jesse Ventura played a part of it, Adrian Adonis, and Dr. D. David Schultz. I'll tell you what, we can tell a lot of stories about that guy. Mm-hmm. And I've talked with him personally at length. He also helped make Hulk Hogan, because Schultz was the absolute best adversary for Hogan. And if you listen to their interviews, and they were best friends outside the ring, Hogan brought Schultz in. He wanted him here, but they were perfect. That all contributed. So it isn't just Hulk Hogan. Yeah, he was a major part of it, but he wasn't the whole picture. And then the fans, let's be honest. By 1980, there were a whole younger set of teenagers that had found pro wrestling. And it was all over the country. We had 20,000 a month at the Civic Center, but Mid-South was selling out at their Superdome down there, and 20,000 people. And the East Coast was out selling 20,000. So wrestling just boomed in the early 80s.
What was, Vern, because you went into the territory, and that kind of brings me to the next question, George. What was Vern's relationship with some of the other promoters, whether it was in Mid-South or, you know, the Mid-Atlantic, or, you know, WWWF, or, you know, World Class? How did these guys get along?
Let's go back and just remember that in the territory days, the wrestling promoters had a fence around their territory, an unnoticed fence where another promoter never came in and promoted a card, and I didn't go into your territory. And all of the promoters in that era, Vern Gagne had an excellent working relationship with Fritz Von Erich, with Paul Bosch, Don Owens, Eddie Graham, Vince McMahon Sr., Roy Scheider, Bill Watts, you name it, Sam Muchnick. He had a great working relationship. They exchanged talent. I'll send you this guy for a couple months. You send me this guy for a couple months. They worked it out for years. And that's the way the business ran. And it ran smoothly like that because they all paid attention to the boundaries. But when Vince McMahon And don't fault the guy. He was a 33-year-old entrepreneur who had just, he'd had time in the business with his dad, but he bought the company. He realized a vision that some of the other older promoters did not see, and he was going to gamble, and he threw the dice, and the rest is history.
I want to say, in regards to Vince McMahon, first of all, his dad, as George was alluding to, it was a handshake. It was a phone call. It was a gentleman's agreement back in the day. But when Vince saw this vision of cable television and the national expanse, nothing was going to get in his way. He did not care to adhere to the old school agreements, the handshakes, the friendships, whatever. He was money driven. And again, as we've said many, many times, he was on the verge of, it could go either way with the WWF back then. But he rolled the dice and it panned out for him. So many people will look at the AWA at the end and say, you know, Vern, he was so stubborn. The guy couldn't change with the times. If only he would have held on to Hulk Hogan, the AWA would still be in business. Well, BS. First of all, none of the old school promoters could compete with Vince. It wasn't just Vern. It was all the promoters that George had mentioned before, Sam Muchnick, Eddie Graham, on and on. They couldn't do it. Vince steamrolled everybody. The old-time promoters tried to band together, but then they started infighting. Who's, you know, we're going to work a show together. Well, whose guy's going to be on top? Who's going to be in the main event? So on and so forth. So Vince is sitting back there, and he's watching all this happen. He's watching the fire burn all around him, and he's living in an asbestos house, basically, is what's happening. And you get the people saying, you know, Hogan, if he would have stayed. No, ladies and gentlemen, I am here to tell you, if Hulk Hogan would have stayed, it would have just delayed the inevitable.
So you're saying, for the record, that whether or not Hogan would have stayed, or whether or not they would have put the belt on Hogan, that would not have mattered in the long term.
In the long term, no, it absolutely would not, because Vince had guys with national appeal besides Hogan. And Hogan, of course, is the big gun, but he had Roddy Piper. He had Sergeant Slaughter. He had a whole slew of guys that he could go to that would have carried the ball. Hogan was a big-time player and all that, of course, but it was the vision. It was the national expansion. It was cable television, and it was Vince's lack of commitment to the old school way of doing things. That's why the AWA did not make it.
So is there anything that could have been done differently from Vern Gagne's perspective? And, you know, maybe, I don't know if it's altering contracts or trying to get better TV. I don't know what it would be. Is there anything that you guys know of that Vern could have done for the AWA to succeed and not kind of fizzle out in the early 90s?
George?
I've wrestled over this, no pun intended, so many times over the years. And I just go back to the same thing Mick just said. I don't honestly believe there is anything that Vern could have done that would have saved the AWA once Vince McMahon was power driven to put it down, take it down. And it was just a matter of time. You know, putting the title on this guy or that guy, I had a fan the other day that said to me, well, Vern shouldn't have put the title on himself when he was 55 years old at the last time. And it shouldn't have been put on Nick when he was 51 years old the last time. And, you know, here's the deal. These guys were far better, and they drew so well for so many decades against a Hulk Hogan. Hulk Hogan was a phenomenal draw, but it was Nick Bockwinkle. I'll go to my grave with this. It was Nick Bockwinkle that made made Hulk Hogan the success he was in the AWA and the launching pad. I agree he was the perfect guy for Vince. He had to have Hogan. And again, if he didn't get Hogan, it may have taken a year or two longer, but he eventually was going to do it, because this old guard of promoters just couldn't see that train coming down the track. They were stubborn, and they felt that Vince Jr. was going to be a flash in the pan. He was going to go bankrupt. He was going to be done. And they had witnessed this through other promotions through the years, all of this.
So they had no reason to think that this wouldn't be any different.
None of them took it seriously. None of them. And that, in hindsight, that was a mistake. But it's also, you know, you can't change history. It is what it is.
You know, Chris, when the AWA was first being invaded by Vince, I remember Wally Carbo was one who would come out on television and talk about the new kid on the block and how they would say, you know, AWA, we wrestle. We're the major league of professional wrestling or whatever. They wanted to delineate. They wanted to make that differentiation between the AWA style of doing things and the WWF's style of doing things. The entertainment and the glitz and the glamour as opposed to old school wrestling. Well, that didn't work. The AWA tried to, they went away from the small studio format for a little while, which I loved. I longed for those days of the 2 out of 3 fall squash matches with Kenny J and what have you. But they went to the Tropicana out east. They went to the Showboat in Las Vegas. They tried to get more a big city glitz and glamour look to it. But by that time, the train had already left the station, and anything that the AWA tried to do looked like they were just a poor imitation of what WWF was doing.
The other thing that fans have to remember is that those old studio matches, they were intended for one purpose, to sell the arena card that was going to take place that night after the TV matches or the following week at the arena. And it was the interviews that were the main event of the TV studio matches. Sure, you had a 2 out of 3 fall match with Kenny J dropping yet another one when he got hit with a boot in the turnbuckle. But you had the interview where these guys would come out and they'd either make you love them or they'd make you hate them with their sarcasm, their arrogance, or lack thereof. And you did what the promotion wanted. You ran, you didn't walk to the box office to get your tickets. That was an old school formula. And it wasn't just in the AWA. This worked all over the country. All of the country, the territories had those type of studio matches. Vince, again, I'll say he rolled the dice. He did something different, but it was a different generation of fans. And those fans, as we've seen it progress, they were more interested. Holy cow. Entrance music. You know, before Hulk Hogan was coming out to a real American in the AWA or what was that wasn't his theme song, Mick, in the AWA.
No, he had the Rocky.
Yes.
Eye of the Tiger by Survivor. Yeah.
Eye of the Tiger. And then you had the Road Warriors who would come out to
Iron Man.
Black Sabbath, was that who did that?
Yes. Yeah.
They were kind of the first ones. But, you know, entrance music, that is something that today's fans, when they hear the music, they cheer. Oh, they're up in the air. And then it takes the guy 10 minutes to come down the runway, slapping hands and fireworks going off. When he gets to the ring, he's introduced, boom, the match is over within 2 minutes. The fans today are entertained by that character coming out, where in our day, I've told people this, we had 4 lights above a ring, the stage where the wrestlers worked, and the arena was dark, folks. Other than that, those lights shining, it was a dark auditorium. When the Crusher would come walking out of the dressing room, you'd hear the rumble of the crowd as he got closer, coming through, and he'd get into the ring and he'd get his cheers. But when the entrance music started, that all became a different story. And today it's about pyrotechnics and entrance music. Beyond that, it's not wrestling anymore. So we had a different vision of it. And I would go back in a heartbeat. Mm-hmm. We had real characters who inside and outside the ring were probably sometimes the same character. But in today's world, Vince says, he looks at a guy and he goes, well, let's see, what can I do for you? Well, I'm going to put a clown suit on you and we're going to call you Doink. Well, you know, what the hell? You don't want to go to see Doink the Clown. I mean, it's not for you. You want a real story where Verd looks at a guy and says, you know what? I'm going to make you an out-of-work, on-strike truck driver who's tired of beating up bullies on the loading dock for free, and you're going to come in here and kick ass and beat guys and get paid for it. That's a character that it went over.
Chris, I know George is about ready for his medication, but I just wanted to say one thing about the AWA's old school formula, and this was brilliant. Before they went to the Sunday morning, where you would watch the show on Sunday mornings, and then the evening you went to the St. Paul Civic Center, they were on television in the Minneapolis market from 6 o'clock until 7:30 in the evening, live TV. And the auditorium show, or the house show, as they called it, usually started about 8:30, 9 o'clock. And typically, the AWA would finish up their TV show with a red-hot angle just before they go at 7:30, getting everybody all fired up. Oh, ladies, you got to get down to the auditorium. And it was a brilliant formula because you just saw this transpire on TV. You had all that fire in your belly to go lay out the $5, $10, whatever it was, to go to the building immediately. It was a brilliant, brilliant formula. And I'm telling you, I miss those days. So much of my psyche when it comes to pro wrestling is back in those old studio days.
I'll give you an example of how they did this when you have that lead in to the auditorium show the very same night. And usually it was around 9 o'clock when the arena show would start. So go back to 1968. As a working a program, Vern Gagne gave his title to Dr. X, the Masked Man, for a 2-week period. So Doc has to be forced into a rematch with the former champion because, you know, Vern had a return contract clause. So the night of the match, the rematch, right on television, they bring in some guy to wrestle Doc on TV. They introduce him out of Hamilton, Ontario, Canada. Ladies and gentlemen, 228 pounds, Billy Red Lions. Okay, ho-hum, big deal, you know. Well, Billy Red Lions, right there. On television, he not only manhandles the world champion Dr. X at that moment, but he beats him with his own figure four leg lock right in the middle of the ring. Lyons does on his debut. He's a nobody. Well, now he's somebody, but the doc is livid. He comes out in the interview area. They bring in this ringer. I got an important match with the champ. I'm defending the title. This is another ploy on Carbo's part to have me beaten and Gagne. Well, it ain't going to work. Well, that night he loses to Vern, of course, loses the title back, but he blames Billy Red Lions. This guy was a one-shot wonder, and he comes out and he's got a ready-made 6-7 month feud with Billy Red Lions. That was the way they promoted it. And my God, Billy Red Lions just defeated him. That's how they promoted. They already moved on from Vern, and you ran, you didn't walk to that box office.
All right, let's go ahead and get into some questions here, guys. We got about 13 minutes left. Now I want to speed through some of these questions that some of our listeners, because we asked for listener engagement, and we want to let you guys know that if you've got a question, and right there you can head to Slick Mix Old School Wrestling and George Shire's Wrestling Time Machine on Facebook and leave a question. And by the way, at the end of the show, we're gonna have an opportunity for you guys to win some of Mick's personal stash. He's going to give you some AWA trivia coming up. You didn't know that, Nick.
I want to just say one thing. I didn't like that medication comment either. I sat here before this podcast started, saw that Karch whiff down a full family size order of fries and a pizza, and he's on me for medication. So go ahead, get your story, get your
question. Okay. All right. This is for you, Mick. I've heard this is from Brandon Dack in Clarkfield. I've heard you say that Wally Carbo would be the middleman between Vern Gagne and the wrestlers. Now, going back and talking to Vern of the wrestlers, when did Carbo start doing that in the AWA? And kind of to piggyback off of that, Eric Peterson from South St. Paul, the relationships that Vern and Wally had from the wrestlers over the years, he'd be interested in hearing about that.
I think we kind of touched on that a little bit earlier on. I would say in the middle 1970s, probably, maybe earlier. I wasn't there. I don't know. But from what I know firsthand and from what I did see, Wally became the buffer when Vern became a little bit less approachable. Vern became kind of entrenched as he wrestled less in the early and mid 1970s. He became more involved in the day-to-day operations in the office itself. So the guys would go to Wally with questions or concerns about the finances or the check or the bookings or the travel. if they had a complaint about a program or a storyline, Wally was the guy that would smooth things over. Vern, on the other hand, was kind of like, yeah, well, if you don't like it, you know, I'm the boss. So that was kind of the relationship that they had with the two of them. And not that there's anything wrong with Vern's approach. Vern was a businessman. He was a professional. He was all business. These are Vern's rules and you abide by them. So there's nothing wrong with that. But in terms of personality, Wally was definitely the go-to guy.
All right.
I'd like to add real quick, just real quick on that. I think Vern's personality changed a little bit because he had started to slow down his own wrestling. And for Vern Gagne to not wrestle, that was tough. Age, father time catches up. And when he started to slow down, he had more hands-on with the promotion. And I think he took over a little bit more. And that's when he became more aggressive in his personality, or it was perceived that he did. And I think that was part of the problem. Vern was so attuned to wrestling that when his alarm clock goes off in the ring, he's ready to get up for a fall. I mean, that's just the way it was. So it was always in his head, in his heart, he wanted to be in the ring. And when he couldn't be anymore, at least as much as he wanted to be, I think that was tough for him.
The next question is for you, George. It's from Brian Huff in Maplewood. And he writes in, could you give us all some background on the relationship between Vern and Wally with Tony and Dennis Stecker? Also, was the transition of power from the Steckers to Gagne and Carbo a smooth process, or was there some resistance to giving up full control of the territory? Thanks for answering my question.
Well, we basically answered that a little bit in today's show, but it was a very transparent transition in 1959. Vern Gagne had always had, and Wally Carbo had always had, an excellent relationship with the Steckers, the Stecker family. And when Dennis wanted to get out, Dennis Stecker wanted to get out and get away from the business, it was a time for Vern and Wally. They put up the money, they bought it, and the fans never knew there was anything different. They never announced on television that Vern or that Wally Carbo was now the promoter. I mean, other than that he was, and that Dennis Stecker was gone. It just pretty much went silent, and they moved into the AWA, and to the fans, it didn't matter. So it was a very good relationship.
All right. Here's something for both of you guys from Ken Heron. Was Vern Gagne so full of himself that he thought he was invincible? And is that how he lost his property via eminent domain?
Oh boy.
Well, if people understand what eminent domain is, it's basically the city or the state or the county that you're in. They come in and they take your property and you don't have a choice. I mean, it is what it is. And that isn't why. So that's why Vern lost his property. But it had nothing to do with anything in the wrestling business. It was just another blow to him at a time in his life when his life was basically in the toilet with the promotion, you know, under scrutiny. And now his home is taken from him, his property. It had nothing to do with it. And he wasn't full of himself. I mean, Vern was, it was just another blow to his personal ego.
I agree completely. And again, as I mentioned just a little bit ago, Vern wasn't full of himself. Vern was, he had an ego, but if you're in the wrestling business, you got to have an ego or you're not going to survive. Right. But he was a businessman. And again, he was old school. This is the way it's done. I expect professionalism. I expect loyalty. And if that translates into being full of himself, then so be it.
All right. Well, we got a few more here, guys. For George from Randy Terrelson in Rice, Minnesota. Why wasn't Billy Robinson given a run with the AWA title? Gagne always wanted the real wrestlers on his cards. We hear a lot about that. And no one was more real than Bill Robinson.
Well, that's a very true assessment. Nobody was more real as far as wrestling goes than Billy Robinson. And I don't think anybody, including the wrestlers themselves, deny that. But the fact is, Billy made a better challenger than he did a champion. Part of it was because Billy didn't have a lot of out-of-ring charisma. And I don't say that as a dig or a fault. Billy just wasn't as charismatic as probably a champion should be. And when he was going against Nick Bockwinkel all those years for the title, Nick as the heel champion, every fan in that arena, whatever arena it was in the AWA, they always left the building that night believing that Billy was the better guy, that he beat Nick pillar to post, and he lost it because of interference from Heenan, or he got disqualified. whatever the story was. So Billy didn't need the title to be over as supposed champion. And that's just the way it was. He made a better challenger. That's my opinion, but it's also fact because Billy didn't need the title.
Here's another one for you, George, from Steve Jensworth in Hastings. I've heard you mention before how Dr. X was so complimentary about the enhancement guys. What was it that he said?
Well, I heard him originally say it about Kenny J, and Red Bastien echoed this. It was at a 1999 Cauliflower Alley reunion, and both Bastien and Dr. X got up on stage and paid credit, you know, to all of the wrestlers that were in attendance, but they both specifically pointed out Kenny J, who happened to be there that night at the banquet. And they both pointed out that without the Kenny J's, plural, of the wrestling business, there would be no Dr. X's and Red Bastien's, because they went out there week after week and they put us over and let us, you know, win over them. But Kenny deserves that type of kudos, and all the Kenny J's, plural. There's so many great enhancement talent. People call them jobbers because that's what their job was, to lose. But in hindsight, we like to be a little more politically correct and give them credit for being enhancement talent. Kenny J, probably, he's as popular as Mad Dog Crusher Vern, anybody in the AWA.
And I actually want to do a show on enhancement talent, because I think it's just, there's so much that can be talked about. And now you look back and you realize that without having the enhancement guys, the superstars don't get to shine, so to speak, you know, that they talk about.
I would point out to you, when you do that, we can talk about all of the enhancement talent that was in wrestling that eventually went on to be big time stars, and especially in the AWA. Mm-hmm. We were a feeding ground for a lot of this talent that later came in the business.
One more question here for you, Mick, and it revolves around Bill Robinson. Let me get it straight here. From Barry Nelson in Robbinsdale, share that story about Billy Robinson slapping a fan for real on television.
Oh, boy. All right, we're going back middle 1970s, and I happen to be at the TV. He didn't slap me, although I'm sure he would have loved to, but
I wish he would have, because you wouldn't be here.
I'm telling you, maybe you ought to double that medication. But anyway, what I was saying, I'm sitting front row, and about two seats to my right is a guy probably in his 20s, kind of a big, bulky guy. I had no idea who he was, but Robinson is in the ring, and he's wrestling an enhancement talent named Mike Spangler, who would come in from Canada. And Robinson has Spangler in a side headlock, and this kid to my right is kind of harassing Robinson a little bit. And come on, Billy, you're not even hurting him. Come on, Billy. Well, at one point in the match, Billy Robinson yells to this kid, shut up. You know, well, the kid didn't shut up, and he kept needling Billy Robinson. Now, mind you, this is live television in Minneapolis, and this match is going to be then circulated all over the AWA territory. On live TV, Billy Robinson got up off the mat, released his side headlock that he had on Mike Spangler, comes out from underneath the ropes. He's standing right in front of this kid now. And I'm thinking to myself, oh, dear God, no. And I'm looking off to the side, and in the studio control room, there's Nick Bockwinkel and Wally. And they're just, oh, God, this can't be happening. So Robinson says to this kid, what did you say to me? You know, and the kid, 20-some years old, gently pokes Billy Robinson in the chest and says, take it easy, Billy, I'm on your side. Boom! Robinson slaps the kid across the face and says, don't ever lay your hands on me again. They 86 the kid from the building. The cop comes over and pulls this kid out. Robinson goes back in the ring, kicks the shit out of Mike Spangler for another minute and a half. And Nick is over there in the control room just shaking his head. And this young punk here, who's writing for a Minneapolis tabloid at the time, wrote it up with a big headline that said, wrestling hero gives own fan bloody lip. which in turn caused the office to send Nick Bockwinkel out as a paid assassin the next time he saw me at the St. Paul Civic Center and said, please, we don't need you doing stuff like that. Now we're going to have lawsuits and blah, blah, blah. But that was kind of an indicator of just how you needed to walk on eggshells. Billy Robinson was not a guy to take a shot at or poke any holes in the wrestling business. Wrong guy, and bad night for the kid. Short night for the kid.
And all right, so we're talking about that. Before we get into the trivia, Mick, one more thing I want to ask you. Is it true that you are single-handedly the man responsible? And I'm going to put myself on the screen. You are the one that is single-handedly responsible for putting the AWA out of business.
Did you hear the story you told about writing it up in a tabloid? Of course, yes.
Your showboat antics, right?
My showboat antics, which were not antics at all. I'll try to make this as brief as possible.
Well, that's not going to happen.
Well, look who's talking. Mr. Vaccinated with a phonograph needle. But anyway, so Larry Nelson is the AWA host for these tapings at the Showboat in Las Vegas. Larry calls me up one day. He says, I'm not coming out there anymore. I can't take it. Vern's driving me nuts. I can't take the stress. You know, God bless you. Go have fun being the host out there. So I'm out there. I'm doing the ring announcing. Comes time for intermission and a tape change. And Vern had instructed me prior to the taping, when we take intermission, I want you to announce the next big card here at the Showboat in Las Vegas coming up, Christmas Spectacular or whatever it was. So I announce the intermission. I'm sitting there with Rod Trongard at the announce table, and then Vern is next to him. And I'm announcing the next card and all the talent on the next card. And I come to the point where I say, and ladies and gentlemen, returning to the AWA, Shawn Michaels. Boom. Crowd starts to erupt. Marty Jannetty, ho-ho! The Midnight Rockers, boom! Roof comes off the place. I said, get your tickets right now. They're on sale out in the lobby. We'll be back in a few minutes. I look over to my right. Rod Trongard has now gotten up and walked away. Rod knows what's coming. He sees the tsunami coming. Vern is as red as a lobster, and he literally grabs me by the lapels of my rented AWA tuxedo. Probably didn't have it in his head. This might have cost him some money for the tux if he would have torn it. But he says, what are you doing? What the hell are you doing? What happened? He says, why did you have to, and he's gritted his teeth now, why did you have to introduce the Midnight Rockers as Shawn Michaels and Marty Jannetty? I said, that's their names, Vern. No. You introduce them as the Midnight Rockers. You don't need to mention them by name. It's guys like you, that would be me, Chris, that have cost the AWA millions of dollars over the years. Not a handful of change. This is a millions of dollars because I announced them. And what I got to add to this is as he's doing this, he's got one hand on the lapels. He takes off his glasses. True story. Throws them on the announce table. The glasses slide off the announce table onto the floor where the lens pops out. One of the lenses pops out of Vern's glasses. So not only have I cost the AWA millions of dollars, Vern had to go get his glasses fixed on top of everything else. So, yeah, effectively in 1987, I was the beginning of the demise of the AWA. There you have it. Blame me, Mick.
I know when we get done with this podcast, you're going to finish that pizza. But I want you to consider maybe not doing that. One word for you. Ganyametrics.
Oh, boy.
Oh, my God. All right. That being said, I think it's going to be time to take it home. I do have one thing for you, Mick, as we're wrapping it up. You said that you were willing to let people win some of your stash. Now, your stash, my stash might be different. But you're...
You don't know that for sure.
Well, that's it. That's true. So, I want you to give the folks out there, if they want to win some of your stash, do you have an AWA trivia question? Because you've got all this merchandise, and I figure why not give it to some of the folks for free, but they got to earn it.
First of all, I didn't agree to it. George agreed that I would give up my stash for the
there tribute. Will be fines and suspensions if you don't do this.
Yeah, we're going to have Wally come out and say goodbye in just a minute. But here's a trivia question for you, and I will send you some AWA merchandise. Maybe I'll throw in some WWF merchandise just for, you know, craps and giggles. But here's the question for you for this week. And again, what are we going to give him, Chris? 48 hours? Be about right?
Yeah, if you're watching this on YouTube, because we have a YouTube channel, and you can also catch us on all the podcast platforms. I'll go through that in a minute. But let's give them 48 hours because this is dropping on January 4th. Let's say till January 6th, and then we'll announce the winner next week. And for every show that we do, how about we give people a 48-hour grace period? Does that sound okay?
That sounds good. And if we have more than one winner, we'll pick a winner at random, and then we'll announce them on the air. So
sounds good.
This question. In the 1960s, 1970s, when Vern Gagne and Wally Carbo were running the AWA, there was a third man who would appear on television every once in a while, and he was given the title of the AWA matchmaker. Wally was the promoter, Vern was the champ, the wrestler. Who was the man that was the AWA matchmaker? That's the trivia question. And again, you're going back to the 1960s, 1970s. I think he finished up probably early to mid 1970s. So there you have it.
That's a good one. So if you think you know the answer, email Mick by January 6th right there, mickkarch@gmail.com. All right, guys, let's go ahead and bring it home. Just want to tell you that you can catch us on all your favorite podcast platforms. We're available. You can see right there if you're watching on YouTube. By the way, there's a little bit of an advantage if you're going to be watching because we've got some pictures and maybe we've got some exclusive things that you can't catch via just the audio podcast. But search for AWA Unleashed on Apple Podcasts or iTunes or Spotify, Pandora, Google Podcasts, Amazon, iHeart, whatever. And if you guys want to do us a solid, subscribe to the YouTube channel. That's great. But also rate, review, and subscribe because that will help us really grow this thing and be able to tell more of these stories because we're planning on taking this thing to incredible heights, but we need you guys' help. So rate, review, subscribe, and give us some feedback, good, bad, or otherwise. Let us know. Head to Slick Mick Old School Wrestling and George Shire's Wrestling Time Machine on Facebook, and also follow on Twitter as well at AWA Unleashed. And guys, next week, I think we've got so many things that we want to talk about. How about this? How about we do a little word association? Meaning, you know, we'll kind of come up with a bunch of topics and we'll just kind of rapid fire through a lot of these. And this will just kind of be, these are some of the things we're going to talk about and we'll just rapidly hit those. So does that sound okay? And then maybe in a couple of weeks, I'd really like to get into talking about Nick Bockwinkel because I know both of you guys knew him personally. And I think that's a great place to start, but maybe next week, we start to tell people, hey, these are kind of some of the things that we're going to talk about. And again, feedback is always welcome.
Love the idea.
You're the referee, but I'll tell you right now, I'm not paying any attention to you.
Oh, and by the way, if you don't subscribe to the channel, there's going to be fights and suspensions. You'll never wrestle in the AWA again.
There you go.
Show yourself out, Wally.